Anne ile. Anne ile.
İsmail Malani. The chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training. I would like to welcome Dr. Gokwana, the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee of Health, and also Dr. Itabe from the professional body that we had invited to come to Parliament. I'll just give a general overview of the purpose of the meeting. The Portfolio Committee on Education has undertaken oversight visits to various institutions, including medical schools, as they are called. We interacted with stakeholders, including academia and student leadership in various institutions. And as we engage with these people, they always made reference to the Health Professions Council of South Africa and the provincial health administrations in regards to the issue of enrollments of particularly medical practitioners. Just for instance, when we engaged with Medunsa, they said the regulations that relate to I would say lecturer-student ratio are the basis for capping of enrollment for medical practitioners. They further indicated that the issue of inadequate availability of beds in hospitals, as they actually characterized this, which meant availability of posts in which people would be placed before they could avail space for them in the institutions. And it felt it would be very important for us to call a joint meeting of the Portfolio Committee of Education and Training and Health to interface with the Health Professionals Council, so that we're able to understand how matters relating to enrollments of the medical practitioners are dealt with. And I am certain that members of Parliament might want to have a general perspective of the shortage of medical professionals in the country and efforts that are perhaps being undertaken to address that aspect. We do hear people talking about shortage of nurses, technicians and other categories of experts that fall under the auspices of this institution. I am going to take this opportunity to allow honorable members to introduce themselves, after which we'll allow Dr. Letabe to give us a presentation in the context of the invitation that was issued to them. And after that presentation, we'll allow members to engage with the presentation, and then there will be such questions and deliberations that may arise from that. I would like to hear anything that my colleague would like to say in relation to that, or he might want us to proceed and then make input in the course of the process. I'll be at one.
Thanks, Mana. It's a pity that one of our members has just sent me a message now saying that she's going to leave early because she's got a male BN cyst. I think that it is that you'll handle that. She doesn't have to leave. This is an ophthalmologist. So Mengombo, you will talk to Litlape. Not Litlape Mpahlele, but Dr. Litlape. So you're going to handle your cyst now. Thank you very much, Manali. We want to, as the Portfolio Committee on Health, we want to thank you honestly for calling us to come here. I think one of the reasons why he decided to call the Portfolio Committee for Health is to make sure that HPCSA doesn't really try and cover certain things. So we must be there to make sure that we protect him if they cover certain things. So we're here. No, definitely we don't think that there's anything to be covered. But as health, we think that as the people are doing oversight in health, we feel that this body that regulates professionals is very important for us. For the problems that are in health, probably you might give us an insight as to why they're like that, so that we can try and sort them out together, or even make suggestions as to how these things will be sorted out. And this group that you are seeing here are the people that probably, if there are certain things that you think that are beyond you, they can sit down and change the laws and amend the laws so that they help us in making sure that the health services in South Africa are better than what they are. And it is on that basis that we thought it was important when Dr. Malala called us to come here and said that we need to come and hear, so that we can help wherever we can help, even if it means amending the laws that we have, because the health situation in South Africa is not a very good one. And we think that the Health Professions Council is one of those that can help us in changing the situation that we are in. And we know the law that made it to be in existence was promulgated in 1974. So probably it's high time that we have to relook at certain things and see what we can do to change it. So with that, Dr. Malala, thank you very much. I didn't tell them who I am. I am Devon Kokwana, the chair of the Portfolio Committee for Health. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. Our name is Crosby Money. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education, Tobe.
Morning, and thanks, Chair. I'm Silence Makubela, a member of the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training as well.
Good morning, and thank you, Chairperson. Jake Dikobo, Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training.
Good morning. My name is Tandwe Kenye, member of the Portfolio Committee for Health. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Duduzi Lesbia. My portfolio committee is Higher Education.
Sanbonani Boihlalo. Ngimuhle Mpontshane, ilunga le committee lezemfundo.
Morning. My name is Rebecca Makosha Mosepe, member of Health Committee.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Patricia Kopani. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee of Health. Thank you.
Morning, everyone. Moweni. I'm Denise Robinson, and I'm a member of the Health Portfolio. Yes, my colleague and I here are both new members, but we're very keen to learn, so we're glad of this opportunity. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Annelie Lotrit, and I'm on the Portfolio Committee for Higher Education and Training.
good morning, everybody. My name is Lowry Bosman, also a member of the Committee of Higher Education and Training.
morning. I'm Beatrice Ngobo, Portfolio Committee House.
Morning, I'm Baki Khanare. I'm in the Portfolio Committee of Health.
Morning, everybody. My name is Mulebogeng Grace Dube, member of Health Portfolio Committee.
Morning, my name is Morwesi Sokhalidiswai, member of the Health Committee.
Thank you very much. May I take this opportunity and give to Dr. Letlape to proceed with the presentation.
Thank you to the co-chairs. My name is Kosi Letlape. I'm a medical doctor by training, specializing in ophthalmology, and currently I'm the acting registrar of the Health Professions Council. We've been asked to come and answer to a few questions relating to the council's function of accreditation and quality assurance in medical education. Now, the overview, I'll give an overview of the Health Professions Council and its structure, the mandate of the Medical and Dental Professions Board, the minimum standards for education and training in medicine, and the accreditation. We'll talk about the process, the history, and the cycles of accreditation. The regulation of the medical qualifications in higher education institutions, the capping of enrollment in medical programs offered by higher education institutions, the role of the Health Professions Council in determining the number of students that may be registered by higher education institutions in medical programs, the overall role of the Council in higher education, and some closing remarks. Now, as Dr. Botswana has mentioned, the Health Professions Council of South Africa was established by the Health Professions Act No. 56 of 1974, as amended in 2007. The driving vision of the Council is quality healthcare standards for all members of the population of South Africa. We are committed to promoting the health of South Africa's population, determining standards of professional education and training, setting and maintaining fair standards of professional practice. The mission is to enhance the quality of health by developing strategic policy frameworks for effective coordination and guidance of the professional board in setting healthcare standards for training and discipline in the professions registered with the council, ensuring ongoing professional competence and fostering compliance with those standards. Section 3F of the amended Act stipulates that the Health Professions Council control and to exercise authority in respect of all matters affecting education and training within its jurisdiction. 15AC further stipulates that professional boards control and exercise authority in respect of all matters affecting the education and training of persons in any health professions falling within the ambit of the professional board. I'd just like to allude to the fact that council structure is that you have the Health Professions Council, which is overarching. You then have the board. But on matters of education, the boards have the absolute authority. The council does not interfere with that mandate. We have 12 professional boards operating under our auspices, representing 29 major professions. And you'll see as you go through the boards that some boards will represent more than one profession. The one that we'll be focusing on today is the medical and dental board. There are other health professions that are not under the ambit of the council, and the ones that would be familiar to all of us would be the Nursing Council, the Pharmacy Council, and with the Allied Health Professions Council, the Dental Technicians Council.
amongst others. Now, the Medical and Dental Board is responsible for regulating health professionals in medicine, clinical associates, dentistry, and medical science. The clinical associate is a new group. The first batch qualified a year or two ago from the Walter Sisulu University. There are other cohorts at this and other institutions. The mandate of the board is to determine and ensure maintenance of minimum standards for professional practice and for professional conduct. To determine and ensure upholding of minimum standards for education and training in medicine, dentistry, and medical science. So today we will confine ourselves to the issues of training. We won't speak about matters of professional conduct. But if there are any questions in that regard, I will take them at the end. Our mandate is to grant certification to compliant practitioners to practice the profession. To register, where applicable, graduates for internship. To register, where applicable, graduates for community service. What does not appear on the slide is that we also register candidates that want to do specialization. Registrar posts are also under the control of the Health Professions Council. The minimum standards for education and training in medicine. We need to ensure that practitioners are competent to practice the medicine profession safely, ethically, and professionally. Used to measure compliance of education and training, the undergraduate education and training, for clinical training, e.g. internship or registrarship, for postgraduate education and training. Now, for those purposes, we have different committees under the board that look at specific levels. We have separate committees for undergraduate education, and we'll have a separate committee for postgraduate education and training. There'll be one specifically for the medical side and one for the dental side at both undergraduate and postgraduate level. Now, when it comes to accreditation, the purpose of accreditation is to promote excellence in educational preparation while assuring the public that graduates of accredited programs are educated in a core set of knowledge and skills required for competent, safe, ethical, effective, and independent professional practice. Now, the focus of the accreditation process will focus on the vision, the mission, the objectives, and outcomes of a university program. We will look at the curriculum design, the content, and the organization. We'll look at the teaching, training, learning, and assessment of student recruitment, safety, support, and guidance. So we basically go through all learning materials and the institution itself. We'll look at student progression and achievement. We'll look at staff recruitment, selection, development of the staff by the institution. We'll look at the educational facilities and the services being offered, the governance and organization of the institution, quality assurance in the institution, and enhancement of quality. Now, the Medical and Dental Board accreditation cycle is 5 years, which is usually followed up by a visit. So if an institution is accredited, the accreditation lasts, if you have full accreditation, it lasts for 5 years. And every 5 years, every institution needs to be reaccredited. Limited accreditation surveys are conducted to support improvement. The universities submit annual reports to the board to report on recommendations that were made by the accreditation committees. Should the institution's facilities or curricula not adhere to minimum standards, accreditation is withheld or withdrawn or may be provided on a provisional basis. but because of the importance of the institutions in service provision as well, it's not a decision that is taken lightly. Because a decision not only has an impact on training, it also has an impact on access to care and service delivery. Now, the history of accreditation. If we look at the University of Limpopo, from 2001 to date, they are accredited for 200 medical students. The University of Pretoria, 2007, were accredited for 220. The University of the Witwatersrand in 2004 was accredited for 240 plus 60 for the entrance program. In 2006, the entrance program increased to 80. In 2010, it's 220 regular medical students and 160 for the entrance program. From the University of the Free State, in 2002, they were accredited for 200 medical students. In 2010, it's 140 medical students. Walter Sisulu University, 2003, 100 students. 2011, 120 students. Stellenbosch, 2003, 200, through to 2011, 250 students. The University of Cape Town has remained at 200 from 2003 through to 2007. University of Natal, 2005, 210, 2010, 210 medical students. Now, the regulation of the medical qualification is done through the Health Professions Act. We evaluate and accredit the higher education institution. We evaluate and accredit clinical training and the professional practice facilities. We register students who are enrolled at higher education institutions for qualifications leading to registration with the Health Professions Council. So we also keep a student register. So we don't only register them at qualification. We conduct board examination to ensure that graduates are fit for registration. Now, in this regard, we recognize the examinations offered by the different institutions because they submit the standards. But for people that come from elsewhere, they would need to sit a board exam after evaluation by the relevant committees. Now, capping of enrollment in medical programs offered by higher education institutions. This determines the maximum number of students that can be enrolled for programs according to the extent to which an institution meets minimum standards for delivery of good quality graduates. The Health Professions Council boards do not cap the number of students that can be enrolled or number of output that should be delivered by the institutions. What we monitor are the staff-student ratios, the facilities themselves, but we don't determine for institutions what numbers they should enroll. There was a time when there were not enough posts to absorb graduates in professions such as medical technology and environmental health. In these cases, the Health Professions Council regulated the size of the intake of first-year students so that we don't produce people that can be absorbed into the system. There is currently no professional board which has restricted numbers of first-year students due to the expansive employment opportunities. We need more people now. There are more posts available, so we do not cap any of the healthcare professions numbers that should be trained by the institution. Now, the role of the council in determining the number of students that may be registered. Enrollment training in higher education is the function of the Department of Higher Education and Training. The department sets enrollment targets for institutions to guide student admission. We have no direct input into the enrollment planning for students to be registered by higher education institutions. That's outside our mandate. The quality assurance of education and training leading to registration with the council through the Health Profession Act is part of our council's responsibility. We have an education training quality assurance standing committee which guide and monitor performance of the professional board. So the ETQA, as we call it, will be a committee of counsel across all the professional boards. Protecting the public by ensuring delivery of competent practitioners who are safe to practice their profession. So each board will have its own education committee, will have its own undergraduate education and training committee. But the council has an education and training quality assurance committee, which is overarching above all the 12 boards. And all the 12 boards are represented in that ETQA committee. Now, the internship registrations that we've had for 2009 to 2011, intent students have risen from 939 in 2009 to 1,049 in 2011. The intents themselves are 1,483 in 2009 and 909 in 2011. Now, one of the reasons the numbers changed is that we now have a two-year internship program. So when we show 909, it'll be double the number because they'll be in the first year, it's 909, and now that we have a second year, the number will be almost double. So at any one point, we have nearly 2,000 interns in the country. Some would be in their first year, some would be in their second year. Now, that's just an overview of what happens inside cancer. But in terms of accreditation, we have defined processes in cancer where the standards of accreditation are set. There's a self-evaluation questionnaire that each institution has to fill. That questionnaire should not be more than 100 pages. So what each institution will do, once they've done the self-evaluation, they will then make 7 copies available of the self-evaluation. An evaluation task team has 7 members, one of whom is a chair. And the 7 are appointed by the medical and dental board. Now, when you embark on an evaluation, the team, once chosen from a panel of accreditors, that is being updated continually. Those 7 members would then be presented to the dean of the institution to be accredited. The dean has a right to object to any of the members of the team. As you know, just like in everything, there's medical politics, and people might feel prejudiced by the presence of a certain member in the panel. So the deans have a right of recusing some of the members of the panel, and the board will reconstitute by replacing the recused member. There might be issues of you move from one institution to another and they feel they might be prejudiced by your opinion because you left. And there are a whole host of reasons why this thing occurs. Now, the self-evaluation report has to be submitted 3 months prior to the evaluation to give the 7-member team a time to go through the document so that when the team presents itself at the institution, they are then able to pick up whatever issues that they want to concentrate on. The document will be assessed in terms of consistency in the presentation of the self-evaluation. And what would be looked at in an evaluation report would be issues of consistency in terms of the courses that are being offered, the staff complement, and the evaluation and the crediting of those course modules in terms of how many NQF points they have. And there has to be consistency in a document from an institution for it to pass the test of evaluation. And all the aspects of the institution, from the admission criteria to the issues of what do they look at in terms of admitting, to the population and the spread of the different population groups in their first year cohort, to the population groups in when the people qualify, to pass rates from their first year cohort. All that information needs to be put into the self-evaluation report. So it is a very extensive document that covers all aspects, including them reporting on what they have to support students, what they have in terms of e-learning, what facilities exist in terms of the library, computer assessment, to do they have tutor groups, do they have mentor groups, and in selection of staff, do students participate? Do they have student representative bodies, or is it just a staff thing? We'll also look at what support do they give to their staff, what training do they give to their staff? What is the research component in the curriculum? What's the exposure of students to research? Do they teach research methodologies? We'll look at the complement of staff members. Now, some of the issues the chair spoke about teacher-learner ratios. In terms of the standards set by council, for clinical years, for example, a 4-to-1 learner-teacher ratio is thought to be excellent. 5-to-9 is good. 8-to-12 is acceptable. And above 30 is considered not to meet the standards. And that's because of the importance of learning in smaller groups. Because if you're a clinical tutor and you have more than 12 people that you have to teach, it's very difficult to attend to whether everybody is coming along. And people might be lost in the process. And we accept that 4-to-1 might be a bit rich. But if you have a ratio of 4-to-1, it's the greatest ratio possible for an environment of individualized attention. 12-to-1, in terms of international standards, is thought to be, you know, the borderline, the maximum to still provide quality education. When you go above those ratios, it is unacceptable. Now, some of the challenges might come from when you look at the different institutions because of our history. They are not all at the same level in terms of the teacher-learner ratios. The traditionally disadvantaged institutions will have a higher ratios. So in terms of the spread of our medical schools, it's no different from what happens in private education and in public education, where the teacher-learner, the classes are smaller. In private education, the classes are bigger in public education. So you see the same difference. The medical schools that have been advantaged, that have existed for a long time, that have great financial resources, have better teacher-learner ratios. The ones that have catered largely for historically disadvantaged people have been historically not as well endowed financially, will have higher learner ratios. But as experience will tell us, because of the attention to detail of cancer, the quality of practitioners produced is really not a concern for public safety. What you will find is that where the ratios of teacher learners are on the high side, the emphasis will be on clinical skills in all institutions. So you'll find that all our graduates tend to have greater clinical skills, but where the ratios are smaller, they'll also have a stronger inclination for research, academic background, and esoteric diseases. But everybody is given a medical education conducive to being a safe practitioner in our practice environment. The practitioners we produce are sought after globally. We lose the majority of the ones that we produce within 5 years of qualification. So I'd like to assure the committees assembled here today that council takes its responsibility of maintenance of standards seriously and of protecting the public seriously. There are challenges in terms of access to medical schools. The demand for a seat in class is still very high in the country. So many people that want to go into medical schools can't get into medical schools. It's a challenge in terms of the selection criteria. And globally, there are studies that are coming out that show that it's very difficult to know who's better suited to this type of sciences. So it's not as straightforward. If you're a straight A student, you'll make a better dentist or a better doctor. And the admission criteria are continually being reformed. If you look at programs like they have at VET, they'll have a track for people that come from historically disadvantaged backgrounds. They'll have programs that support them before they get into the mainstream. I mean, traditionally, where Dr. Kotwana comes from, they used to have a prelim year, which with time was phased out as the quality of education at matric was improving. But initially, there was a prelim year, and when we started, the prelim year had been phased out, and some institutions dabbled with a five-year program. They are all now going back to a six-year program. So all these issues are being continually looked at by the academics and the people in the field. The issue of bed availability and posts, that's something where we set the standards, but we're not really in control of how many beds are available, because that's a function of funding, that's a function of a DOH and services that are offered by the government. The issue of posts, it's also not under our control. But the duty that we have is to ensure that an institution has enough posts that are filled for the numbers of students that they take on, so as not to compromise the quality of education that the students are going to receive. The enrollment of medical students, those issues of who to choose are not under the control of cancer. Those are institutional matters. What we assess in their reports is the demographic diversity of their student population, the gender distribution of their student population, and feedback is given to the institutions on those matters. I'm happy to take any question. And I thought it's always difficult is how much you talk about this issue. I have documents that have details about the accreditation process where there's far more information on those issues. Every year, the institutions have to give us a qualitative analysis. So the issue of the analysis of students, the support they give, the numbers, those are annual reports. The quantitative analysis only has to be done every 5 years. If there's a major change in an institution, if, for example, they change their program from a six-year program to a five-year program, they then need to report to CANSA, even if their accreditation cycle is still outside. If there are any major changes, they are expected to report and will send a team to go and look as to whether they are the necessary changes. They've accommodated that in terms of staff complement and improving the facility to be appropriate to the changes that they have made.
Thank you very much. I think Dr. Littlebe gave us quite a very incisive and thoroughgoing presentation. I'm going to take this moment to permit members to engage with the presentation. Honorable Gawa.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I concur, very clear presentation. Our thanks to Dr. Khosilitlame. Basically, my questions revolve around two things. On the role of the council, it's unfortunate that I'm going to squeeze this question in. Just the issue of fostering compliance, you know, the issue of the board examinations, I have a fair idea now of what will happen to a South African who would like to study in this field. I would like to know, and Dr. Letlap would understand why I'm asking this question, how we check people who come from outside. I want to know this issue of board examination. Is it only for those, in other words, our graduates before they practice? What happens? And I guess it has, you'll guess that it has something to do with what we had of somebody who presented himself as a neurologist and somehow managed to practice. I mean, this fellow was so brave, didn't even say I'm a general practitioner, for heaven's sake. Says I'm a neurologist and somehow went throughout the net and practiced. I just want to know and understand. The other one relates to the issue of the lecturer-student ratio. And again, I think Dr. Altaf will appreciate our concern, but we want more doctors. We want more doctors. But of course, we don't want, you know, these doctors being produced in conditions that are not conducive to producing quality doctors and all those things. Now, I'm playing with the idea of a 4-to-1, which he calls reach. And then the 12-to-1, which he calls, you know, is nearly bad, but still acceptable. In other words, it's your we are stretched the rubber band too far. Now, in terms of where we are now, because I know it might be, as we talk now, there are those who will say for us it's 4-to-1 and nothing else. And maybe those who say no, because of the problems in our country and the challenges that we face as a country, we are prepared to go to 12-to-1. Now, I want to understand, where are we now? Because we have been informed that there is one particular university that responded, FET, I think it is, to their call by the minister to say, please, let's help the country, let's admit more. You are saying you are not capable. All what you are saying is that if you have so many lecturers, you can't have so many students. In this case, you say your max is 1-to-12. Where are these universities? Could it be that there are those who are saying no and they are at 4-to-1? Or maybe those who are saying no and maybe they are at 5-to-1? I would like to. I don't know if he has that information. Thanks.
Take the 6 questions from the members then. Proceed in that way. I know that Dr. Tlape is quite an expert, so he could absorb many questions with very condensed answers to members.
Okay, Chair. Thanks once more. I just have got a few questions. Some will not be very substantive, just for one's clarity. But of course, there will be those that caused us to be here, which probably there will be some bit of answers to. But my first will be whether the council, as overarching as we indicated, and the 12th board, the current status quo, that arrangement, is not presenting any challenges. Is it all systems go, it's fine, and you're so comfortable with that, or there are emerging questions or challenges from time to time? And probably it may need a relook into that. Earlier, when the chairperson Higher Education and Training gave the overview, he also hinted on the lack of or shortage of nurses in the country. I take it the country is aware of that. But now that you're saying there's a council or they're operating outside of your ambit, does it mean that probably, yeah, it will be unfair for you to talk to the matter? We needed to focus on that structure and not necessarily you, because you may not be having that mandate to engage on it. The third, unfortunately, your slides or pages are not numbered. I will have difficulty to draw you to a specific one, but I think you will remember. There's a point where you're saying you look into these institutions also in terms of their governance and organization and so on. We could retrieve that just for you to be more clear. But my interest on that aspect will be simply on whether you are able to sort of get or even make an input insofar as some councils fail
and at the end of the day they are even removed, if that is something that you also interact with or it does not relate to it. The last two chairs, which I think are a major issue to me, the accreditation or the intake of students that you referred to, on those two pages you referred to, the timelines are different. To me, they don't obviously talk to the five-year cycle. If I were to get there, unless if I'm not very clear, on World Justice School, for instance, it will be 2003, 8, and 11. And then another, it will be, say, 2003, 5, and 2007. And KwaZulu-Natal will be 2005 and 10. And all I'm saying is, in some you'll end at 2007, in some you'll go as far as 2011. And I was also interested in that, those differences. But just to take that question a bit further, if an institution is to take a particular number, can that affect for that cycle how they will be proceeding? For instance, if there's an appeal, like it has been made by Dr. Mutualeti, on institutions, I know you said you don't necessarily engage on it, but probably you know what may be obtaining in that area. If there's an appeal to, say, expand the intake, mid-cycle, unless if it's those institutions which must decide, because they as well may then say or resist somewhat or be, there be attitudinal matters to say whether they can take or may not take, and therefore there be challenges in terms of how that is supposed to be implemented. Lastly, sir, when we're in Medunsa, former Medunsa, we're told that probably it will be on those specializations and so on, that a student may not be allowed to even study privately. That has to be okayed by your institution, and there be posts or whether it's number of beds and all that, whatever language you use. But then that if I have money and I may need to study privately, not depending on government and all that, as if that is bad or prohibited. Perhaps we need more light in that particular regard. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation. My colleague has already said the problem of not numbering. Now I just put my own number, 17, on the history of accreditation. Maybe to further to put more question around the numbers, I would like to know why the University of Pretoria was only 2007. I would also want to know the University of Free State. Why the reduction? And I would like to know what determines the number. That is that on that page. But I would like again to know, because here we have reports only on the accreditation of universities. But I know that the medical student doesn't only see his or her life in the university. He has to do some practicals along the way. How involved is the council on the accreditation of hospitals and clinics which the students need to do their practicals? And how involved is the council in knowing where in Cuba our students are set? How involved are you there? Because we do send our medical students
at a certain period of the year in Cuba, and we're still having the students there. And when they come back, it is understood that they do another year of training. I want an elaboration on that, because this added year which they do when they come back, it is something new. Initially, it was not there. What made us to have that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Some of my questions have been covered. For example, I'm also interested in the decrease at the Free State University. But can I go on to the role of the HPSCA in checking on ethical behavior and proper standards? Now, I'd just like to know what you do if there is a doctor who has, for example, been reported for defrauding health plans, insurers, or perhaps just not being competent, because one does hear frightening stories of people who are not being competent. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think quite a number of my questions have also been asked, but still also on the history of accreditation, and then also Dr. Letlape indicating that the council doesn't cap student numbers. If one looks at the need there is, plus the figures we have here in terms of the history of accreditation, and then it is said that figures aren't capped, so I understand that to be that universities can enroll more students than what is given here, for example. Would that not have a negative effect on the accreditation later on? Because the question is, this is what they are accredited for in terms of their resources, capacity, lecturer-student ratios, etc. So couldn't one then surmise that it's not really in their own interest to increase the numbers because it could negatively affect on the accreditation?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I think some of the questions are duplications, but maybe I can just highlight also my own view on this. We know that there are shortages of specifically medical people in the medical field, as well as on some of the other medical fields that we need to address. If we look at the figures, the history of the figures, we see that it's very stable. There's no real increase, and I've calculated more or less around 1,570 students, the capacity of all the institutions and universities together. Now, for forward planning, and I think we know that we need to improve and increase the numbers of medical practitioners in future. What are the planning to increase this numbers? Is it going to be improved by creating the other two new universities in Mpumalanga and Northern Cape, or are we going to have a look at the universities itself to increase and improve that numbers? The other question that I would like to ask, maybe if you have the information, is what are the shortages in the different fields at the moment? And as I pointed out, that it seems to us that specifically in the medical field, there's no improvement in the numbers. What are we going to plan to increase and improve the numbers in future? Because I think we cannot continue at the rate of professional practitioners per capita at the moment as it is. So maybe if we can just have a little bit more information on what is your planning for the future.
Thanks, Chairperson. To add on to what my colleague has just been saying, maybe you can share with us also how many doctors, ex-student doctors, that you register per annum. Is it any different from what was being registered in 1993? And secondly, how come that our pipeline is not improving? Or if it's improving, it's just by few numbers compared to the needs of the country. The other question you may answer or you may not answer. We have a problem of exodus of doctors, as you also did mention that our doctors are needed worldwide because of the training that we give to them. When the doctors leave the country, do they deregister with HPCSA or they just leave? And it's not easy to account where they are, or it is easy to account where they are. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think all of us are interested in the history of accreditation because really these numbers are 1+1 to me. More than that, I don't understand. You know, the first question is from me is I never heard you say anything about the student who registers but who becomes dropout, because I would personally like to know the intake and the exit, because there's no use for us registering students, but at the end of the day, they cannot compete. If you can share a little bit of information around that. And also maybe the reason behind that, is it financial, is it racial, is it gender, you know, girls for pregnant on the way, just to highlight to share some light with us. But also in the universities, if we are in the University of Cape Town, I come from Gauteng. Is there any way where I can be refused to register in Cape Town University? Because the geographic spread vis-a-vis the quality of university that we have is also a challenge. And also the gender part of it. Do you have any information that you can share with us towards women vis-a-vis men? And the color, you know, you know, how many of us are registering and at the end of the day are exiting as qualified doctors? The last one is around the numbers. Here in the University of Stellenbosch, people asked about the decline. I'm asking about the increase vis-a-vis the numbers and the explanation that I bought that is a little bit general to me. If you can clarify now. The Stellenbosch has increased, the other ones are declining. I thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Dr. Chape, under presentation overview, your Romans 6 and 7 talk about keeping of enrollment in medical programs, and the other one says the role of your HPCSA in determining the number of students that may be registered. From what I read here, that somehow you do play a role of ensuring that there is a keeping of the number of students which has got to be taken in. And at one point you said that in the past, the one of the boards somehow prohibited the intake of medical technologies, and now they are no more doing that. In terms of the universities, because the call has been there since 1994 that we are running short of medical personnel, have any universities approached you, or have you spoken to any of the university to say the elements which are a stumbling block towards you increasing your intake, how are we systematically going to address that? Because the issue is not only the equipment, it's lecturers, it's all other elements. How are we addressing those particular elements to ensure that we increase our intake?
Dr. Chape to deal with those questions. Maybe let me take also the last one.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe this question is asked, but it is asked partly. As you said that your role, the role of the council in higher education is also to protect the public.
by ensuring delivery of competent practitioners who are safe to practice their profession. I'm asking this question because some of the foreign doctors, some of them do come, and also I want to check if you really evaluate in that team, you evaluated the foreign doctors, because some of them, they come here, and if they are competent, and then they perform surgery. For example, in Eastern Cape, one doctor, Dr. Kokona was the MEC by that time. One doctor was found to be to have performed a laparotomy operation of the opening of the abdomen without, at the end of the day, that he was found to be a false surgeon. Therefore, now I'm worried about the protection of the public. Do you compensate those patients? What is the policy? Do you compensate the patients who happened to be done those operations? And also, how do you deal with that problem? Noting that that is a foreign doctor who comes from another country. Thank you.
I see another hand.
Yeah, mine is to check on the issue of accreditation and quality assurance. I've been trying to grasp to what extent are our universities, institutions of higher learning, producing quality research? Is your accreditation focusing on specialization on research? And which are institutions that, at least as South Africans, can be proud that are keen in focusing on research disciplines, particularly specialization. The second one, Chair, you have raised the issue here, as other people have raised, of lecture ratio, with the problem that we are confronted with. To what extent are we committed very soon to expand the intake that we have on higher education in terms of medical practitioners, not only to general practitioners, but to specialized areas in which we have shortages? What commitment do you have as a council to make sure that you at least support institutions that want to increase specialization in different fields?
Can we make up before you come? Maybe can we ask everybody to introduce themselves, where they are coming from. Maybe if you could just tell us who you are. I'm getting worried, Dr. Elizabeth, that they are only talking about foreign doctors. Some of them are looking towards me. They think that because I'm deaf, I might be one of those doctors. Okay, can you introduce yourself?
Okay, I'm Ngaba Banga, a member of higher education portfolio committee from the Congress of the People.
Thank you, Chair. My question is very simple. I just wanted to find out from Dr. Tab, in terms of fostering the compliance with regard to the standards, how many doctors have been deregistered and how many cases are still pending, maybe annually? Maybe you can have a said what is exactly happening.
We'll take now this moment for doctor to answer the questions. As it is always our experience, members always ask beyond even the mandate there, you know, and chairpersons are always constrained by one rule of parliament, that this freedom of debate and engagement. So that is a moment to handle all the questions.
Thank you, Chair. The first question was about the board exams and how we check people that come from outside. Just in terms of our own, the exams that are conducted at our own institutions have been assessed to be sufficient for qualification purposes. So if you've passed at Stellenbosch, we will register you. the standards of the exams are being looked at. And continually, we've been battling for more than 20, 30 years as to can we get a standard exit exam at undergraduate level. And that is fraught with difficulty because you run into the autonomy of the institutions. So the exams offered at the institutions are sufficient for registration purposes for our own students that we produce. At a postgraduate level, there's been an agreement that there will be a single exit exam for specialist purposes. And those would be the exams conducted by the College of Medicine of South Africa. So at a senior level, when you're training to be a specialist, you're now expected to write the exit exam, the final exam offered by the College of Medicine, so that it's standard for all institutions. So the M.Med, Wits, M.Med, Stellenbosch, M.Med, Medunsa has been done away with at a postgraduate level. But at an undergraduate level, we still recognize the different exams. Now, for people coming from outside, if you come from certain jurisdictions that we recognize, you go into what we call a non-exam stream. For example, if you qualified in the UK and you registered with the General Medical Council of the UK, there is no need for an exam stream for you. But you still need to provide us with your papers. You need to give us notarized certificates of your graduation, your curriculum, your registration with council, and if you're a specialist, the appropriate papers that are notarized, and a certificate of good standing of where you're working and your recent curriculum vitae. We then have a further step where everybody, we verify everybody's qualifications and registrations with an organization called Education Committee for Foreign Medical Graduates, which is an organization in the U.S. that offer a credentialing service, independent credentialing service. So any practitioner from outside that needs to be registered with CANSA will have to meet the requirements and at their own cost ensure that they are verified by ECFMG. So on receipt of all the notarized documentation and the ECFMG verification, each candidate is then presented to a committee. So we have two committees. One is a committee for people that want to be general practitioners, and one is for postgraduate education. So if you want to be registered as a specialist, it goes to the specialist committee. If you want to be registered as a GP or as a general dentist, it goes to the GP committee. Now, because of the challenges that we've had, we've made ECFMG a prerequisite before your application can be lodged with the committee. The committee will then assess whether you need to sit an exam or whether, depending on where you come from, they're satisfied with your credentialing. If you come from the UK, for example, and you give us all the papers, you'll be registered in the appropriate category. But for all people coming from outside, no one will be given a license to go into private practice. So all foreign graduates will be licensed for public service. Now, if you come from a country where you feel you need to do an exam stream, for general practice, we have what we call a board exam. The way the board exam is conducted is that it is conducted by the different universities. For example, the last exam that was done in October, November was conducted by Pretoria and Natal. So all the foreign graduates that are required to do the exam would be given the information that they can go and sit for the exam either at the University of KZN or University of Pretoria. And the practical part was being conducted at the University of Pretoria. The next exam will be conducted in the University of Cape Town. So, and there's a pool of examiners that look at the standards, the moderation, etc. If you want to register as a specialist, you're going to pass the appropriate College of Medicine exam.
So that's basically the standard for foreigners that come into foreign qualified graduates. There are a few problems that we have with South Africans that have foreign qualifications. And some of them pertain to the fact that the Department of Health does not offer internship to any foreign qualified graduate. There's an exemption for 10 countries in Africa that don't have medical schools. For example, Swaziland hasn't got a medical school. So if Swaziland has taken someone for education either in the UK and they need to do internship, they can make an arrangement with the Department of Health. But barring those 10 that don't have medical schools, everyone has to give us the verification that they've done their internship elsewhere. We don't offer internship. It creates a problem where we have some of our children that, because they couldn't get into medical school, go to the Gulf University and their parents pay for them and they graduate and they need to come back to do internship. And those matters would be referred to the Foreign Workforce Management Program inside the Department of Health for adjudication. I hope that answers the question about the standards that we have for foreign qualified graduates. And once you've passed the board exam, that's for general practice, you then be registered for practice in the public service for 3 years. And after 3 years, you go to reapply for renewal of registration. Now, after some time, these people can then apply to go into independent practice. But for the first 3 years, you will work in public service only. Now, the way it is structured right now is that if you're from Africa, there's a government-to-government agreement not to poach from Africa. So anybody, any doctor or dentist that comes from Africa has to first apply to the Department of Health for permission to apply to us for registration because of the government-to-government agreement. So they apply to the Foreign Workforce Management Program. And unless they come with a letter to us where they've been cleared by the Department of Health that they can apply for registration, they will not be considered for registration. But all other graduates from anywhere in the world can apply directly with CANSA for registration and just have to meet the criteria. Now, maybe the same question also wanted answers to the neurosurgeon. What went wrong with Dr. Katumba? A lot of things went wrong with Dr. Katumba. But we still have to submit a report to the Minister of Health because the Minister has asked us to look at this issue. So I will not be, as a matter of proper, I won't be too elaborate in the answer that I give to respect the Minister's office. But effectively what happened, I'll tell you the things that are in the public domain. Dr. Katumba trained as a doctor in the DRC and qualified as a doctor in the DRC. He then worked there as a general practitioner and worked in private practice. In the early 80s, he then went to Belgium for further studies. He worked for 2 years in surgery as a registrar, as a trainee surgeon in Belgium for 2 years, then worked for 2 years as a trainee neurologist, and then worked for 4 years as a trainee neurosurgeon in a Catholic university in Belgium and finished his 4 year of training in 1991. He then came and worked in Zimbabwe as a neurosurgeon, and then they threw him out. He then went to Botswana to work as a neurosurgeon, and they threw him out. And around 2001, he applied to work as a neurosurgeon in South Africa. He was assessed through the normal processes, and it was determined that he needs to write an exam to register as a neurosurgeon. So he supplied all his documentation, which were not notarized, and supplied his log books for training. He had a CV, he had recommendations from people that trained him, recommendation letters from the professors, but he never had a certificate that said registered in Belgium as a neurosurgeon.
So it was then decided that Dr. Katumba must write the college exam, which he wrote in 2004 and failed. He then disappeared from the system, reappeared in 2005, trying to register for the board exam for GPs, and was refused because he was from Africa by the Department of Health Foreign Workforce Management Program. So in 2005, he registered for the exam, but it was discovered before he set that he didn't qualify for the exam because at that time there was a moratorium. He then reappears to apply again in 2006, and in January 2007, we have a minute recorded of his application in the minute of Postgraduate Education and Training Medical Committee. And it's very brief that says Dr. Katumba has passed the board exam and Dr. Katumba is now being registered as a neurosurgeon. Now, there are things that are incompatible. To register as a neurosurgeon, you need to pass the college exam, which had failed in 2004, and you wouldn't use a board exam to register as a specialist. You'd use the board exam to register as a GP. So that's an inconsistency that has been picked up. But be that as it may, he was not qualifying, but he was registered with cancer. And what has come up is that there seems to be collusion with staff members in terms of that improper registration. When it was discovered, when he was reported at bar for incompetence, we then looked through his registration and saw that it was not compliant. We then wrote to him to say, there's documentation that you never gave us. Please give us this in such and such a period of time. If you don't, we're going to erase you. Needless to say, he couldn't support the verifying document that we're missing in his files, and he was deregistered. He's still threatening to take us to court. But I hope that answers the Katumba matter, and there'll be a further report that will be submitted to the minister, who can then provide more details in terms of the irregularities that were found inside cancer. Now, there's a common theme that has come through about the lecturer-student ratio. Just to go back to the history of accreditation, like I said, every 5 years there'll be a compulsory accreditation. But in between, people, when they change programs, they inform us, and there'll be an ad hoc accreditation done. That's why when you look at Natal, they went by the book, they were accredited in 2005, and they were re-accredited in 2010, and the numbers were the same, 210, that they took it. Now, the others, you'll see Stellenbosch 2003 and reassessed again. In 2008, it was 5 years later. But it's in 3 years, 2011, they reassessed because they were intending to increase their intake to 250. And for that, because their circumstance changes, they inform cancer and the accreditation team gets sent out to see whether they can take 250 students. So when they needed to bump up, they made a request and it would be accommodated outside the five-year cycle. And you'll see pretty much the same. Walter Sisulu 2003-2008, bumping up by 20, and you see there was a visit 2011. Now, when we say we did not determine the numbers, they decide what numbers they're going to train. And we decide whether they have a system that is sufficient to carry those numbers. That's what we mean by we don't cap. So they can have the capability to train 1,000 and choose to train 50. We don't prescribe on those issues. They can have the capability to train 300 and choose 200. Okay? But if they have a capability to train 50 and they want to train 100, there'll be a problem. So I hope that explains the concept that we don't cap. We don't determine numbers. We just know in terms of norms and standards what you are capable of taking on. So if you go beyond your capabilities, we'll have an engagement with you. But most people are operating within the capabilities of the framework. So we're just saying in terms of international standards, 4-to-1 ratio is an excellent ratio. But it doesn't mean the institutions are at 4-to-1. It means all of them will be within the 12-to-1. Some might be at 4-to-1, some might be at 9-to-1. So we'd have to go into each report to give you the evaluation for each institution. But each institution meets our minimum standards in terms of those ratios. How many students they take is dependent on
the institution's appetite, and it's an institutional arrangement. Remember, the students that you take in is a balancing act about your responsibilities for teaching, your responsibilities for service, your responsibilities for research, and the number of posts that you are able to fill. And that becomes an institutional decision that is made. And that's what we mean that we don't cap. The historical aspect of capping is that, you know, there were professions that were budgeting. For example, in optometry, the optometrist used to regulate the numbers. They'd say, how many do we need? How many are we going to train? So they were able to regulate so that you don't have an overproduction and you have over-servicing and all the consequent challenges where practitioners cannot make a living and they start augmenting how they earn a living. We think it's a bit artificial, but those are things that some of the boards used to do. None of the boards are engaged in that right now because there's a demand. We can't produce enough people for the job, that the posts that are out there. So there are no caps at the moment. Now, the arrangement of the HPCSA and the 12 boards, is it sufficient for now? I guess maybe you may be alluding to some wanting to break away or issues like that. Now let me explain that. Historically, the Medical and Dental Board used to have its own council, which was the Medical and Dental Council. And in the new dispensation, there was a movement to having an overarching health professions council that would have been overarching over all professions. But somehow, the nurses escaped before they got into the crawl, and the pharmacists bolted too. There's a history behind that bolting. But be that as it may, the medical and dental was then joined with 11 other boards to be under one council. Now, there's really nothing wrong with the arrangement because each board has full authority on professional matters. It is not interfered with by council. Council won't come and say to the medical and dental board, give Stellenbosch 1,000 students or reduce them to 175. So those are purely left to the boards. And the boards are populated by members of the profession. So the professions are in control of professional matters. So when you hear the issue when professionals can't get away with certain issues of ethical and conduct issues, professional arrangements, practice arrangements, wanting to practice electronically without seeing a patient, hello doctor, and all those other things, when they get unfavorable responses from council on those issues of business practices, they will then want to break away when there's something that makes them unhappy. But the door is open. Remember, council has two functions. One is to guide the profession. The other is to protect the public. Now, protection of the public is not going to be negotiated with the profession. It's not going to be on the basis that the professions agree or disagree. The protection of the public resides with council. And there are sometimes tensions between the professionals and council in terms of protecting the public. And those tensions are necessary tensions. If they are not there, then the system would falter. I mean, if there's no tension between your financial director and your CEO, your company will go bankrupt, or you'll be an Enron in the making. So there are some tensions that are appropriate tensions. But in my humble opinion, there's nothing really wrong with the current structures that you have. The Health Professions Council could even accommodate the other professions and become overarching. You'd still have the Nursing Council become a board, and they would still reside over professional matters. You know, discipline issues are board specific. So the psychology board will discipline psychologists. The medical and dental board will listen to complaints about doctors and dentists. So there is appropriate independence at board level. But you need an overarching structure for protection of the public. It can't reside in each and every board. So the institutional arrangements right now, there's nothing wrong with the institutional arrangement. If there are tensions, we're happy to listen to the issues and engage with the different stakeholders on the issues that they bring forward. The issue of Sama wanting to break away had to do with changes in terms of public protection. A part of the history is that the public was concerned about the fact that when doctors are brought up for serious violations, they walk. And we thought, you know, it's a medical brother bond where we buddy-buddy with each other. And because of that, they thought an increased presence of members of the public in disciplinary inquiries might yield better results. There was even a change that the chair of the inquiries should be one of the non-professional people. And that those are part of the tensions that bodies like SAMA are raising. And those are issues that we prepare to engage in and find a better working model to ensure that there's fairness in terms of the duty of protection of the public. The shortage of nurses in the country, I mean, the minister has spoken to those issues. There were tactical mistakes that were made where, you know, we closed things that worked for no reason. I mean, if you go back to the fact that a fair number of people I know, including myself, were raised by nurses, it was because nursing arrangements were structured such that it was a low barriers to entry profession. You came from a poor background, you could go into nursing, there was a stipend, there were no fees, you'd go in, and it was a profession, it was not a degree, there were ethics that were taught, there were people that were enabled, that were able to raise families on being professional nurses. Now all that was dismantled in the interest of progress to go into nursing becoming university education, colleges being closed down, etc., etc. And I hope the members of this committee will play a role in going back to the model of that work in terms of promotion of ethics, promotion of great standards, but a career choice for largely women from historically disadvantaged backgrounds that were able to get into something where you didn't have to get a bursary and make loans, etc., and you could come out being a professional, useful to society, and you could earn a living and have a decent life as a mother, a father, and a professional. But those matters belong to the nursing council, but they are in the public eye, so I can only comment in terms of what is in the public domain. The failure of university councils. We have no role in how those are constituted. Those are competences of higher education and the ministry in terms of their composition. But where we have a duty is to ensure that the institution has proper structures that run the institution. You have an office of the dean that works. You have administration in the institution that works. You have accountability in terms of funding. You have proper administration, proper criteria in terms of giving people an opportunity to apply and having a variety of students coming into your institution. Those are the governance, institutional governance issues that we look at. The issue of the constitution of a council of a university, that's totally outside our mandate, and those are things that we have no control over. The ministerial request of increased uptake and ability to ramp up. As I've said,
you know, it's really up to the institutions to do that. But it has major implications. Remember, the dynamics inside an institution, when you have posts that are not filled, professionals that are not adequately remunerated, no time for research, a burden on the service side, not enough staff complements, and you allow them to go and do overtime outside. And some of them, the overtime takes over the full-time job, and the quality of supervision and the quality of training comes down. There are challenges in terms of the work conditions of the professionals in the institution. And there needs to be a concerted effort to improve that work environment in terms of better remuneration, in terms of better funding, so that you can increase the number of posts, so that the capacity to take more students can be increased. But there are other constraints in terms of the pipeline in medical school. We start through basic sciences, and we still believe that you can't be a doctor if you have never dissected. So there will be constraints in terms of the anatomy classes, the number, the hall, the dissection hall, the number of cadavers available, and because that's where we start. So there's a challenge in terms of expanding the numbers at a basic level. You know, on the clinical side, it's not that big a problem because you can build bigger hospitals, have more beds, etc. But if you can't build bigger anatomy laboratories, if you can't build bigger physiology laboratories, says Dr. Kotwana, I'll tell you, the training would entail that, you know, all of us have to battle with a life cat and trying to get the muscle to do certain things at certain times. There's a limit to the number of laboratory spots you could have in a laboratory. So that becomes a limitation in terms of the undergraduate intake, in terms of first and second and basic medical science intake. That has an impact in terms of the outflow up to the clinical years. So that has to be borne in mind in terms of the limitation of institutions to increase the numbers. There are novel ways that have been devised globally. I visited a medical school in Taiwan where they've created virtual cadavers. And people are able to have the dissecting skills without having to be limited to a human body in front of them. Unfortunately, those innovations have not yet reached our shores. So there are things that could be looked at in terms of that aspect. But there will be limitations about intake because what the institutions have to look at is all their other responsibilities. You know, I mean, the Council for Higher Education wants research output. The registrars for specialization are expected now. You will not be registered until you have done research. So you will not register as a specialist going forward until the research component has been dealt with. So remember that increases the burden of responsibility on the consultants and the lecturers because they now also have to supervise the research. And we're not increasing the numbers. So there are serious challenges, but it doesn't mean they can't ramp up. As Vets showed, they could take 30 extra, and they've been able to increase. I think there's a philosophical challenge. You're going to change the paradigm of how the heads of the institutions operate. And when that paradigm shift occurs, they can take more students in. But it requires them to move from this is how we've always done things to say this is what our country needs us to do. And we can be creative, maintain standards, and increase numbers. So that's a debate that we should have, and the institutions should be challenged to increase the numbers. As Vets showed, after they increased the numbers, they went to the minister to say, we need funding. He gave them more money, and the others are now competing with Vets, and they will increase their numbers. The question that was raised about Free State decreasing numbers, we'll come to it. I'm fascinated by it, but there are challenges in Free State. I mean, to date, they haven't been able to fill the post of the dean.
or the medical school. They still have an acting dean. So there might be challenges in terms of attracting staff, the staff complement, and as it decreases, they do the responsible thing of reducing the numbers of the people that they take in. So we probably need to look at getting a report from them, and we could, I could ensure that that issue is looked at properly, and we could provide a full report from the institution with respect to what were the reasons to going down. For Mame Dunsa, the question of private studies. You know, healthcare is a contact sport. When you reduce it to 7-day MBAs, the quality of what gets produced cannot be guaranteed not to harm society. Now, there's a limit to doing private studies when you need the contact time, when you need to be in a clinically supervised environment with an experienced, ethical and dedicated teacher and patient in front of you for you to learn. You can't do that privately. And that becomes the limiting factor. So when we see people where they do medicine by correspondence and they come from foreign countries, we will not mention them by name, they sit there and they think putting out a drip is like drilling for oil. They think it's guesswork. You keep pushing a needle, and if you're lucky, blood will come through. And we've seen it as you train, where people can't even put up a drip. And a person ends up with a fenestrated hand because they don't have the basics of put a tourniquet, block, get venous engorgement, choose a vein, clean, put a drip in. That's what happens when you think you can do medicine by correspondence. So people have to be cautious about this notion that such an intensely personal discipline, which is a contact sport, can be done by correspondence. Because what you will produce is a correspondent doctor, and they will be corresponding with the mortician about the treatment of the patient. So I would advise caution about doing. Medicine is about our own personal health.
Chair, may I just say something without interrupting? Yeah, I guess there's some kind of misunderstanding, possibly because of how the question was phrased. Because it was about when we say people want to come in, there are no bursaries and all those things. What if my parent is ready to pay for my study? In other words, paying privately, not depending on a bursary from anybody. My parents can afford it. And Medwinta was saying that is problematic. Maybe that's where the private part came in. It was about private funding in order to study, not to study by correspondence.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that aspect. That would create problems. People might not be aware, but studying in medicine and dentistry is heavily subsidized by the state. So even the fees that you pay are not commensurate to the cost of training. And if we created an avenue for private paying of fees, most people that go out there, you either get a bursary or you pay your fees. So and every student has to pay their fees. And all of us are privately funded. If you don't have a bursary, you pay. There's nobody that goes into medical school gratis. Everybody is presented with a fee schedule and they need to pay. If you can't pay, you don't get results, you get excluded for non-payment, etc., etc. So the notion of I can pay is a misplaced notion. And it would create a great injustice for deserving students from parents that can't pay. And if a parent says, I can pay, what are you actually paying? Are you paying the 5% of fees that are subsidized, or are you saying, I will pay the full 100% complement of what this would constitute in a private medical school, for example? And that would create a dynamic that would be difficult to manage.
because all those with ordinary means just to pay the prescribed school fees would be crowded out. So I have a challenge understanding when they say they can pay, what do they mean? Because all students pay, from my understanding. So you know, or is it you paying for the lecturer's pool at home so that your child can come in?
Through you, sir. I think this came to me at some stage.
Mm-hmm.
And when we discussed it, I misunderstood it totally. It was only after we sat again. I would just want to request that probably even now, much as this is supposed to be for the public to hear the answer, but I would suggest that maybe after this meeting, we meet again, because I had scheduled myself to go to Medusa because I thought it was something that needed to be sorted out there. So maybe after this meeting, we'll meet with you so that we can understand it properly, because I think there's some other misunderstanding about that particular problem. I'm just making that request.
Yeah. You know, I think it needs to be unpacked, because all of us are grossly subsidized. Even with bursaries, we're grossly subsidized. Even when your parents pay out of their pockets, you're grossly subsidized. And we hope that the institutions would look at criteria of deserving students without looking at their pockets. We hope that would be the first criteria to create an equitable environment. And those that qualify to come in and can't pay, there should be a concerted effort to support them to pay those fees. And if there's greater clarity, would be able to engage better with that question. Now, the history of accreditation, you know, University of Pretoria 2007, I hope I explained that the cycles are 5 years, but in between, when something material changes, they notify us and there will be an evaluation of the changes. University of Free State coming down, you know, I can only hazard a guess, but the appropriate thing would be to go back to the report of the institution or ask the institutions to give an explanation as to what was happening. The accreditation of hospitals and the teaching component, the issue of practicals, that's exactly what we do. You see, for example, there's a new request for a new medical school in Limpopo. So what you'd look at basic sciences. You'd look at the lecture halls, the tutorials, the support, the breakaways, the size of the class, the number of lectures given, the staff complement. And then when you get to the clinical years, you'll then look into the beds available, the number of consultants available, the number of medical officers, the theaters, the laboratory, the other facilities. So you do a comprehensive analysis of the facilities readiness. That is intermingled with the service environment, but we will do that aspect. So we do not license them for working as hospitals. We accredit them for being teaching institutions. The service component and the licensing of the hospital, it's a Department of Health competence. Our competence relates to education and training. So we have our own models of assessing the institutions for that aspect, including the clinical training. So it's not just about the basic sciences. It's also about the clinical training, the availability of staff, the seniority of the staff, the numbers of the staff, the number of beds available, the number of people that you are accommodating, the number of students that you do. So that analysis is done per institution and it's accredited for the teaching side. So we can withdraw the teaching accreditation. It doesn't mean they can't service patients. You know, there are institutions that will be accredited as to whether they can take intent, for example. Not every hospital can take intent. And we can withdraw the accreditation of internship because you don't have the appropriate number of supervisors, they are working on their own, etc., etc. But you still continue working as a hospital. And what we must not lose sight of is the fact that even though they work as interns, they are a critical component of service delivery.
Without them, these institutions would not be able to cope with the service demand. The issue about Cuba. When there was a government-to-government agreement on Cuba and sending our children to go and train in Cuba, the same standards were applied. There was an accreditation team that left South Africa. One of the accreditation members was Professor Mfenyane. So there was a full team of seven that went to Cuba to go and do an accreditation of those training facilities. And they were found to be compliant for training. So the standards were not compromised. The same thing that we do for our institutions were done for the centers that train our children when they get to Cuba. Now, on the aspect of them coming back, we found that when they came back, there were certain deficiencies as it relates to clinical effectiveness. And part of the major problem was the language barrier. They're trained in Spanish. So they need to come back, they need to adapt to South Africa, where we're working on largely English media and all our other languages. So there was a challenge in terms of them adapting to the South African condition. To the extent that the current arrangement is that they will do their final year assessment here. So they will come and work in a South African institution, and they will write the final year exam here and begin to be integrated into the South African healthcare system. Because them coming as a Cuban graduate created challenges. Because what the agreement was, they would train them as medical students, but they wouldn't do their internship in Cuba. So they'd come back, do their final year here, get reintegrated, and do their internship in South Africa. Those are the arrangements in relation to Cuba. The others that come as qualified doctors on a government-to-government agreement, those are registered doctors in Cuba of Cuban descent that come in and work in our underserviced areas. That's a totally different program to the one of our own children that go out there to medical school in Cuba. The checking on ethical behavior and proper standards. Anyone, any member of the public or anyone on anyone's behalf can lodge a complaint about any of the practitioners registered with the Health Professions Council. We then, by law, have to look into that complaint. We have a public relations department and a legal department that even helps people frame their complaints, because sometimes our people are not very literate. They have a legitimate complaint, but they can't frame it properly. So they'll be offered assistance to frame it properly. Once a written complaint has been received by council, it is our duty to notify the practitioner and ask for a response to that complaint. What then happens is that on receipt of the practitioner explanation about the complaint, it would then serve at a committee. Lately, there are lots of disputes about money. You charged me 5 rands, it was 3 rands, etc. And those disputes, or he didn't say hello, he's rude, are referred to the ombudsperson. And the ombudsperson would then get the complainant and the practitioner together and try and mediate. And a lot of issues are resolved at that level. But matters of substance, the explanation from the practitioner and the complaint would then serve at a committee of inquiry, at a preliminary committee of inquiry. Now we have 4 preliminary committees of inquiry. 1 to 3 are on general medical issues. 4 are on sexual misconduct complaints, which unfortunately are on the increase, and they require a specialized committee. So there's committee 4 that deals with that. Now, when a matter serves at a committee will look at a complaint and look at the doctor's or the dentist or the practitioner's explanation. If it is necessary, the office will ensure that whatever is deemed to be necessary to help the committee make a decision on the matter will be made available to the committee. If we need to get hospital records, we'll request them. If we need to get the doctor's notes, we'll request them. So any information that would be necessary would be accumulated. The matter would then serve at a prelim committee, and the prelim committee can conclude the matter by either accepting the explanation and providing the explanation to the complainant, or conclude the matter by finding the practitioner guilty, warning them, or fining them. So there are powers at prelim level lately where you could fine a practitioner, you could send them for remedial education, you could send them for anger management. So there are censures that can be levied at a prelim level. If the committee feels the matter is of a serious nature to even warrant deregistration, the matter would then be referred to inquiry. That then means you're going to have a formal inquiry, and the counsel would then prepare a charge sheet that would then be sent out to the doctor, and there'd be a formal full hearing where the doctor can bring legal representation, and there will be a prosecutor. There will be three members of the committee that sit and adjudicate on that matter. So a matter like the kidney doctors, for example, would be a matter that would proceed to inquiry. Matters of major fraud, where a practitioner has defrauded patients or funds of millions and millions of rand, it will be referred to inquiry. Matters where people have become humped, sometimes irreversibly, sometimes with serious morbidity, those matters would be referred to inquiry. So it's up to the prelim committee to see whether it can conclude the matter or it needs to send it to inquiry. The majority of the matters are concluded at a prelim level, and the other matters are sent through to full inquiry, which can, the biggest censure that we have is to remove you from the register of practitioners. And if there are issues of a criminal nature, we can also press criminal charges afterwards. The complainants are also free to lay criminal charges or pursue matters in civil courts. Some of the matters drag on because the complainant are suing the doctor in court, and the lawyers of the doctor say, we want the court to run its course first. I mean, there's a doctor that was accused of sexual misconduct, of rape. It took 8 years for the matter to be concluded in the court. He relocated from Cape Town to Witbank, and there were 5 further matters that were recorded on the doctor. There are limitations as to what we can do. So when a matter is with the court, that particular doctor, the matter was heard, and the doctor was removed from the register. He then appealed, and the court ordered the Health Professions Council to reverse the decision, to await the outcome of the trial, which took 8 years. He has now recently been sentenced to prison for 8 to 15 years. And what happens when a practitioner has been found guilty in a criminal court and sent to prison? We then have to follow a process of notifying them, and we follow a process of suspending them from the register. And when they come out, they then have to apply for re-registration. Once you've been removed from a register, you can only be put back on application, and that application will then be considered at the time. So some people will be removed from the register for 5 years, etc. That aspect creates challenges because when people are removed from the register, they are no longer under jurisdiction. So we're looking at reforming the laws in cancer where practitioners will be registered because of their qualifications. They'd then also be licensed to practice. So on misconduct, we will withdraw the license to practice, but we will keep you on the register so that we still have jurisdiction over you. Because registration is based on qualifications. Practice is based on competence and conduct. And when there are issues with that, we can remove the license, but we'll still keep you on the register. But it also has other advantages.
people like the Honorable Dr. Vivian Gotwana can still register and not practice. And any time he wanted to go back to practice, would have a duty to ensure that he's safe to practice. Just register, but the license to practice we will not issue. You'll have to go under supervision. So the issue of competence globally is a problem. You know, it's easy to say you qualified or you're not qualified. If you go back to Katumba's issue, Katumba does not meet a criteria for registration. But even if he met it, there's issues of competence, which are separate. I mean, I'm registered as an ophthalmologist. I have been for more than 20 years. It does not necessarily mean that I'm competent. And it's far, far more difficult to assess competence. And that is dependent on something going wrong, people having the courage to report. And we have a major, major challenge where colleagues have great difficulty reporting incompetence. Firstly, because we've got no whistleblower protection. And if you're working with somebody, you know, and you think they are not competent, and you report them for questions of competence, if it comes out that you reported them, the working relationship is irretrievably broken down. And sometimes the incompetent person can be your boss. What happens then? I mean, we've said as intent, and you say this medical officer is not competent. He's a licensed killing machine, and there's nothing you can do under current regulation. He's just an intent. He's going to sign you off for intention. Him and his other boss have to sign you off for intention. You whistle blow, you'll never be taken anywhere. Nobody would want you. You'll never complete your internship anyway. So there are those challenges. And we've asked our legal department to look at a mechanism of creating a whistleblowing act where they will be protected. People will come and complain on condition of anonymity. And the first thing that a practitioner does is, I want to know who complained about me. I need to know my accusers. So unless there's a proper framework that provides protection, there's a lot of issues of incompetence that will never come to the surface. So there are challenges in terms of assessment of competence. I think the capping of numbers is a repeat, and I've answered that. We don't decide. We'll just decide if they want to train 1,500 and say, you know, this is beyond the outside capabilities. But everybody can bump up in terms of the criteria that we have. But they have to look at other issues. Any plans to increase numbers of medical students? More schools or more students? I think it's both. It's not either. It's both. We need more schools, and the current schools can take more students. Now, the issue of more schools, we're looking at the application from the University of Limpopo for a separate medical school in Limpopo. And I'm hopeful that during this calendar year, they will meet the requirements. There were issues that have been raised to the application. They're addressing those issues, and there will be another accreditation team that will go in to go and evaluate whether they fill the gaps that were identified in the previous application. And I'm hopeful that they will be accredited to start a medical school this year. The shortages of medical doctors. The shortages will always be there. And there are shortages across. But what I want the honorable members to understand is that we are not even retaining 90% of what we produce in 3 years. There have been studies that have shown that as much as 50% of some cohorts we lose in 5 to 6 years post-graduation.
So there are things that can be done. But going back to the issues that we raised about the gross subsidization of training of medical doctors and dentists. In similar environments, when people get trained as pilots, they get trained for 5 years and they will serve for 5 years before they can be released. And I hope these are things that we should begin to look at. We train you for 6 years, you will serve for 6 years, or we will pay us the full commercial cost of training you. And those are the things that need to be looked at. If we can retain what we produce, we'll have a higher increase in numbers than the increase in numbers from the foreign graduates that come in. So we're losing more than we get in terms of our own production capabilities. So these are things that we need to seriously look at in terms of what can we do to retain, what can we do to keep people. I wouldn't say Dr. Gotwana was lost to the profession, but what people do not consider is that there are a lot of medical practitioners in South Africa that stay in, that stay on the register, but are not practicing medicine. They go to other things that are more profitable. They go to other things where they feel they are more appreciated. Well, you know, tenders help. But you know, we don't lose them all to tenders. Some of you may have seen a movie that was released last week called Materia. The producer of that movie is a qualified medical doctor who left the profession to go. He was a comedian and he's now produced a movie. And there are many other people that go into alternate professions. I mean, you want to work as a medical officer of 10, 15 years experience? You'll earn more as an honorable MEC's assistant working behind him with a briefcase. And a lot of people that are going into administration for those reasons. So it's not an issue of tender pioneering. If you go into Civitas and you count the number of healthcare professionals that have left the profession and gone into administration, it's frightening. So there are many people that get lost to the business world, to industry, and we need to improve the working conditions to attract them back. Dropout rate and reason for dropping out, that requires a separate report. Work has been done on that. I'll get the report and I'll forward them to the chairs of the committee. But there are many reasons for dropping out. Part of them is not being prepared for university, not being prepared for medical school, not being breathed in, not being prepared for that social atmosphere. So some of it is not just about learning and the gap. Some of it is about people not fitting socially, people not being accustomed to the social freedom that they don't know what to do with. You know, you've come from a curfew arrangement where you're a straight A student and a curfew arrangement of 6 p.m. you're behind the gate. And suddenly you get to university, 1 a.m. nobody cares where you are. And there are no social skills for them to adapt with this newfound freedom. So there are various reasons why people drop out. And academic incompatibility is probably lower down the scale. Our young people are too young to be independent. You know, when you look at the American system, they go to college. College is glorified boarding school. And it's only after that that they go into mainstream professional channels. They'd be 23, 24 once they do that. If you're unfortunate like me, you get to university, you're 17. You know, I mean, you couldn't spit.
Now you can spit, you can swear, you can drink, you can do anything you want. And there are no social skills to deal with the new freedom that our young people have. That contributes to the issues of divorce. The academic things, there are mentoring systems, there are two-year streams, there are, you know, programs for people that come from disadvantaged backgrounds, but there are far, far greater challenges that our kids face. You know, you can afford, you couldn't afford Kool-Aid. You can now afford Johnny Walker from your bursary. A frightening change in circumstances. If you're in Gauteng, can you register in your city? Those are things that I can't give you a real answer to. In terms of the criteria that we see, they don't discriminate against where you come from. You know, so it would be very difficult to give an answer. My daughter came to UCT for 2 years. I'm from Johannesburg. Unfortunately, she dropped out. You know, after expensive private education, she came in 2 years at medical school and she dropped out. And it was not because of academics. It was because it was a different scenario. She dropped out because we took away her skills of dealing with race. We raised her in a protective environment where we raised her not to see color. We raised her as a human being. She came to Cape Town. She just became another black girl. And we had not given her any skills to deal with it. Her best friend became white, and she became black. And she never recovered from that. So those are the many things that contribute to dropouts. It's not simply an issue of an educational gap. The major contribution, in my humble opinion, is poor parenting, like I wasn't a good parent to my daughter, and the social aspect that has a major role to play. Gender representation. The new cohorts, there are more females than males. More females are getting into medical school, and a lot of the younger classes, first year, second year, the females outnumber the males. Not only do they outnumber them, they also outperform them. But there's a challenge in terms of workforce preparation. We need to ensure that our work environment changes to accommodate a female workforce. Currently, our work environment is designed around the male. They don't have to get pregnant. They don't have time for their families. They work horrible hours, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now, females work differently. When they qualify, both male and female are at the height, at the peak of their reproductive prowess. That's when they get married. That's when they start families. And we need to change the work environment to be more accommodative of female graduates and female aspirations. The increasing numbers at Stellenbosch, I've explained. Rolling capping, we've discussed. Foreign doctor evaluation, I've dealt with that. Production of quality research with specialities. That's the greatest challenge with quality research is service requirement and not enough time. If you are on a joint academic and service post, your responsibilities are ongoing research for yourself, support research students, teach medical students, teach registrars, and provide services to patients. And there's not enough time in a day to accommodate them. Our staff complements are such that something will always suffer. And in the last 10, 20 years, what has suffered the most is the research component. And that's why it's been made compulsory that you're not going to register as a specialist if you haven't done research. So it will begin to increase the research output of the institution. But staff complements and time management and immense responsibilities are a problem. If you compare us with overseas institutions, for example, in the U.S., that the people who are in research, that means the American doctors, but they don't see patients. They work in the basement of the building, and they live and breathe and sleep research. That's all they do. And that's why they have high research outputs. For us, you got to juggle. You got to do all these other responsibilities and still produce research. Can we expand intake of medical practitioners? Yes, we can. But we've got to understand adjustments have to be made on other things. Fostering compliance in terms of standards, the issue of deregistered doctors. As I've explained, once you deregistered, you can't practice. And the only way you can practice legally is to be re-registered. And when people finish their sentence, they'll apply for re-registration, and it will be sent to the relevant committee for it to look at. And if they need to impose certain restrictions on the registration, they will do so. If you've been in prison, you know, we have a colleague that killed his spouse and was sentenced to 18 years. He came out of prison and he wanted to go back to the profession. We had to insist on practicing under supervision. And when you practice under supervision, we'd expect quarterly reports from the supervisor to counsel, and that would serve at the relevant committee. And if you have supervised practice for a year, after a year, there'd be an evaluation based on the reports that come from the supervisor, and sometimes, if there are behavioral issues, from the assessment of the health committee. There's a special committee in council called the health committee that looks at impaired physicians. And that ranges from physical impairment. There are people that get involved in MVAs and are no longer able to carry out the duties that they could do before. There are people that have addictive problems, substance abuse, et cetera, behavioral problems that would be helped by the health committee. And there would be a psychiatrist assigned to assessing that practitioner, and depending on the report, they would be put under supervised practice. Those are the questions that I had so far. And after a glass of water, we can go for the second round.
I think I must say that Dr. Kotwana will later on summarize for us as to what our perspective is about tackling our challenges. You've raised very important issues to us, including the fact that a manager for public participation at the municipality probably ends above a medical practitioner at a hospital, you know. A senior manager for human resources in a department ends more than a practitioner. A human resource officer who's privileged, maybe in the private sector or even the public service, might earn more than a senior researcher at the university. Those are very genuine things we get to hear from professors. I met the registrar of the University of Pretoria when we just related some of the challenges affecting academia. In academia, nowadays, they use contracts, half-year contracts. You are a professor. You want a big house. You want to drive a better car. Take care of your children. And there is this post of a director in a department about 700,000 per annum, and you're earning 400,000 and so on. You weigh options. You end up forgetting your professional status and you just feel I could just be an administrator there and float with the system? Those are general questions that you raised. I think for me, on the question of massification of the profession, we then see that there is a responsibility of the national department, the provincial departments, and of the deans of these institutions. And also where you come in to say, in terms of our standards, this is what must be met. And then there must be some collaborative common response to be able to say, we're going to be able to enhance the numbers, to avail the requisite resources to be able to meet your standards and move forward. And this points to the importance, perhaps, of having a meeting for the Department of Education and Training, have, perhaps including the provinces, with yourselves as our council, and the relevant boards, and the deans, to unlock this question, because my worry, colleagues, is that as Parliament, we may make recommendations in the House, and they get adopted, but there is recurrence of the same problem that we want to address. And our country says there is a need for enhancing access in the sector. And when we met with the academics, they could not open up the books and say, look, in terms of our meeting of requirements, this is where we stand. We should meet this. They've only pointed to the aspect of resources from the state and mentioned very tersely your requirements. And that is why we felt if we need to, we'll be more empowered, as we are now, to have a clear picture of this issue and know exactly how we could actually tackle it very effectively. I think we need to move towards that meeting where all these stakeholders could come under one roof and say, how do we unlock intake? We need to unlock that. And there are possibilities. And I know that consistently, people, particularly in academia, are very quick to say institutional autonomy. And to understand what they are trying to say. But here, as government, we're talking about openness, transparency, and accountability. For the last few years of democratic governance, we have not come to interrogate how things are going on in this public institution. Yet, we are prepared to pump billions in them. Billions. We don't even want to know how these billions are used, because we think we'll break the crust of this institutional autonomy. I think public accountability, transparency, and openness, which are the foundational values of our democracy, will trump this element of institutional autonomy. It can win against those fundamentals of our constitution. There's a need for us to engage with all these sorts of reports, for us to penetrate deeper, to look at the inherent structural limitations of these various institutions, that always causes us more to increase the intake of new entrants in the health sector and other areas of interest to our country. So this is the beginning, in my view, of that journey to clearly characterize the interplay of institutional autonomy and the fact that these institutions are not independent. We are talking of public institutions here. They are under the auspices of the state. They are funded massively by the state. They must be responsive to the strategic imperatives of the state. We should set that tone so that every dean, principal, student and citizen and non-citizen should then understand that as a country, we have got particular, quantifiable milestones that we must achieve as a country through those institutions, particularly in relation to human resource development for our country, to even supply for the continent, to even supply for BRICS, so that if there's an oversupply of optometrists, for instance, then they could go and work anywhere elsewhere. There is a shortage in the world. So we should then unlock that thinking about our role in society to tackle questions of humanity. I'll take this moment and meet my colleague to just wrap up for us. I'm certain that the questions that members raised and the responses that were provided have shaped and influenced the way in which we're going to begin to tackle the issues very progressively for the better. And I should take this moment on my side to thank you for the very incisive input. It has really, really assisted us to understand the intricacies of your field, which we always see as a very complex one, you see. That is why we thought you should come here and brief us and not make a recommendation in the House about how things must be resolved before that sort of going engagement that could help our country.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm hoping that there was nobody was going to wanted to make a follow-up, because it seems as if we're wrapping up now. And thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much for inviting us to come here. And I think I agree with you that this is a very intricate portfolio. I mean, the HPSA says you can be confused by the terminology that comes. But fortunately, Jose didn't confuse us. He used the simple language so that you all could understand what is going on. So our work, he made it very easy, because he wanted us to protect you from that intricate sort of language. I think basically what the interest here was to look at the quantities of the health professionals in South Africa, but we know that does not reside with you. What resides with you is the quality of those professionals that are coming. But the portfolio committees were interested in the quantities, but unfortunately, when you get to those quantities, you've got to get to the qualities of them, and that's where you actually fit in. There's no doubt about it that the quality of the health professionals in South Africa probably is quite good. And I think I agree with everybody who says all over the world we are wanted. In fact, I had an offer to America at some stage. When I stopped being an MSc for health, I had an offer to go to work in Australia, but I refused. But I think the key thing here that probably the chairperson is trying to work on is whether there is transformation. Because of our bad past, we do understand some of the things that you mentioned. But you mentioned something on that transformation, which actually, there's a question that came here, which was saying, you get 40 students getting admitted in Witwatersrand, but at the end you get about 2 qualifying as doctors. What happens in between? I think you've mentioned a lot of reasons probably why, But I think for the members is to, how do you make those who are coming from the historically disadvantaged area to be able to manage? Because if you look at those statistics that you are going to give us, you will find that when you are coming from a particular race group, they don't have as big a challenge as those that are coming from the historically disadvantaged. You can go to your statistics, you'll find that. In fact, to be honest, what I'm saying is that if I'm a white student, I go to FETS, the challenges that you mentioned are not that much as compared to me coming from Pringle, getting into FETS. You find that I get more challenges than the other one. So if you could look at the, this is where we're talking about transformation. Is there transformation? And in fact, you summed it up when you mentioned your daughter's challenge. It really summed everything up. But by saying you protected her, and obviously doesn't know what apartheid is. Though she reads about it, but she doesn't know because you protected her from your home. But when she went into UCT, she started seeing apartheid in its true culture. And it made her to go the way that she went. And that sums up the transformation that we're trying to look for. And obviously we're not saying that this thing would just take a day, it's an event. It's going to be a process where we try and make sure that we incorporate. And in fact, that this impacts even on the elections that happened with SAMA, that happens with SAMA, even the HCCSA, because there are elections. Now, if you've got 100, most of us were born during apartheid. Now, if you were born that time and your attitude is still at that level, when we vote for the board or for SAMA, most of the doctors are white. They're going to vote in that paradigm. And so you find that those people that are more in this country, that are contributing about 80%, are not going to feature in those elections because they are fewer, because of the fact that there's not many of them are being produced in this university. I think that that's the key thing that is trying to be said here. The other challenge that I think is very important is the monitoring, which I think the HPCSA is supposed to be doing. I'm not sure whether do you have enough staff, the quantities, do you have the quantities of the staff to do the monitoring, and do you have the quality of the people? Because what you're mentioning about the neurosurgeon is that it seems as if the quality of the people that are in HPCSA, that this is my understanding, the quality of people, they are corruptible. People that are in your staff, but I'm not trying to say that we want the report now. We don't want the report, but obviously there's somebody who did something wrong there. Meaning that the quality of those people that are working are not good enough, let alone the quantity. Because if you look at the surgeries that we have all over South Africa, I don't think you've got the quantity of people to monitor. Let alone that you have mentioned something of the whistleblower type of thing, which is a challenge. But I think it's something that probably we need to look into, and we need to assist you in making sure that people are monitored. Probably the other interesting part is that we're talking to members of parliament who've got constituencies. And I think we've got a tendency of running away from the health issues, even if there are certain things that are wrong. But I think as members of parliament with our constituencies, we need not to be afraid of mentioning things that we think that they are wrong. Because they might not have enough staff to monitor every GP that is around in South Africa. But we are there to actually take those things and make sure that we bring to them that, look, in such and such a corner, the doctor was doing 1, 2, and 3. Can you go and handle it? Because we see these things, and some of them, they're actually done to us. So I think we need to assist. The retention of professionals, I agree that there's a lot of reasons why people leave. But I think it's something that probably needs to be done, where we look at, I think some of the professionals, they don't live because of salaries. But on the other side, the department needs to help them to make sure that they stay where they are. I don't think, it has been very hurting sometimes when you find doctors are being taken to court because they are leaving the way they were supposed to train, but you don't look at the conditions that they work under. I mean, some of us are coming from rural areas. When you go to those rural areas, you find that the doctor is there, there's no equipment that is for him to work, and obviously that person is qualified to work anywhere. So the best thing for me, irrespective of the salary, but because there's no equipment in Kasatu, I just decide, okay, let me get into my car and go and look for a job somewhere. Or in some of the departments, you find that you apply for a job as a doctor, and you're told that, okay, we're going to process your application. It takes 3 months to process that application. And you can never do that with people who are doctors who are very mobile. Because somebody is going to phone you and say, I've got a job for you, come. As long as they are registered with the HTCSA, come, I've got a job for you. But some departments, they will take 3 months to process that application, and what's happening to that person. So probably what you need, Chairperson, as a recommendation, we need probably another meeting with you, because this has been eye-opening for most of the people. We need it was an eye-opener, but we need a meeting where it's not only going to be the HPCSA, it's going to be you, it's going to be the deans, because they are the ones who claim that they are autonomous, they can do as they wish, and they are the ones who know who comes to first day and who gets out at the end. And we need, because we're talking about doctors, probably we need summer to be part of that meeting. And the Department of Health would be key in that meeting, so that we can actually plan and move forward to see how can we improve the quantities and the qualities of our health professionals in South Africa. And as the politicians ourselves, we definitely, having looked at your legal status on the whistleblower, but you need to tell us, because these are lawmakers, you need to tell us where do we need to come in to fast-track that amendment or making that law, so that at least we can help you not to be frustrated by some of the things that are frustrating you at this time and moment, and specifically this whistleblower. I do want to talk, Chairperson, in case I would be subjective, because, of course, we've been together from first year to final year, so we know each other from very far. I would end up being subjective, not being hard on him. So that's why I decided not to talk. But at the end, I've got to talk. So we think that we're going to be able to change South Africa for the better if we look at those things. Thank you very much for inviting us. Thank you very much for your presentation, Jose. I think it's still as good as you were when you were. By the way, you got a medal. You got an award when you qualified. That was many years ago. You got an award as one of the best students. You remember that, Jose? You got an award there. So you see, he's still as good as I used to know him, listening to his presentation. But we're here to help. Maybe I should have told you, Jose, why I ended up in politics. Somebody went to look for a brain because he wanted to be intelligent. Now, when he went into this shop, there were two brains that were being sold, were left. One of them was 5 million, the other one was 5,000. Now, he said, I'm interested in the 5 million one because I think because it's expensive, it should be good. But the problem, the one that was 5 million, was from a politician. Now, he didn't really trust it. And the one that was 5,000, which was very cheap for him, was from an academician, a professor. Now, he asked the question, why is this one so cheap and that one so expensive? And then the marketer said, no, the reason this one is so cheap is because it has been used so much, because it comes from a professor. The other one, they're coming from the politicians, because politicians are resting, are doing nothing. It has been resting, so that's why it's so expensive. So I decided to come and rest here in Parliament.
We should thank you for having come, and we'll still engage with you for further interaction on the basis of this platform. This heralds the end of our meeting. Thank you very much, honorable members, for your input. The Higher Education Portfolio Committee will remain. We must process some minutes. As we had agreed always that we must approve our minutes every subsequent meeting. Thank you.
This discrimination.
It's a house without a top steward, eh?
We're left with 10 minutes to go in case we have lunch. In our first meeting this year, we kept the adoption of a draft report on our study tour to the Federal Republic of Germany that took place from the 2nd to 9th of December, because members requested a further period to study the report, and we believe that in the subsequent meeting the report could be adopted. I'll be guided by members if they had sufficient time to peruse the report so that we could adopt it, and there are further 2 minutes that we may have to adopt and also look
at matters arising, if any. The report has been circulated for a while now, and I'm advised that also the minutes have been sent to members accordingly. So you probably have perused them. Let me allow members an opportunity to reflect maybe on the report.
So, Chair, that we had time to go and look at the report. Personally, I found the report to be a true reflection of what transpired to the end, capturing almost everything that we did with various institutions and so on. And perhaps I might not have been able to see some of the things, but even in terms of language and all that, being sexual, grammatical and all that, I found it to be fine. I have not picked necessarily issues. But what I wanted to say here is that with regard to particularly the recommendations, they do capture most of the things, but I felt there are others that ultimately are not part to those recommendations. And it may be for those who helped put this report to then go and try and capture everything. For instance, if you go to page 15, and I'm not saying that's the only one, page 15, 5.1.3, we have that issue that we need to be making a follow-up with the Mpumalanga provincial government. And I think that one in particular, probably it's captured on the recommendation. But it's possible that it may not be there. I've not looked at it now, Chair. I actually looked at those issues that we needed to be doing follow-up for that actually cause for an action on our part to do something. So I'm saying that even if that one is captured there, but there are those that are not captured. If you go to page 17 as well, 5.4.6, the first sentence there on top, is another issue that we do need to look at and see how we take it forward. Like I said, that some of the things are captured. I'm not sure whether you want me to capture almost everything. Like when you go to 5.4.9 under that, about the partnerships which that university has only with the best performing Western Cape institutions, the issue will be that probably we need to look at whether we can explore that even with regard to those historically disadvantaged ones. I can go on and on, Chair, in terms of those. Let me see if I still have got more. Yeah, there will be more. But it's a way that I'm saying we could do something about it. Then there's one on 5.6.3, which is captured on the other side. That one I've seen. And 5.8.4 on the FET college lecturers who will benefit being trained at this facility and so on and so on. It's work again that we need to do. 5.9.9 is also another area which we need to take forward. So, Chair, I'm just saying those, if they were not captured on the recommendations, because it's not everything that is captured there. We need to be able to ensure that all those actions are not lost. We have them as some program of action that should be handled. And I think the other one is the year of science, that partnership that we have got with them, which we will be able to handle. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, sir.
But as it is, Chair, I think we all agree that this is a true reflection of what happened, and we can adopt the minutes. But then, bearing in mind that you just need to come up with a program of action from the minutes that are here, I think I'll be moving for the adoption of the minutes, Chair. Because I don't think the program of action should be part of the minutes. Then from these minutes, we can then draw up the program of action from what is being captured here.
The suggestion is that let's go and incorporate some of the recommendations that are not properly articulated in the recommendations must advance to plenary. That's meaning we have adopted this report with those incorporations. Okay. I'm sure she was moving for adoption. Any second?
Yes, Chair, I'm standing to second the adoption of the minutes.
Okay. Thank you.
No, it's fine. What I'm just trying to check is that because I seem to be hearing the Honourable Makuela proposing one or two additions, maybe just enriching the report. I guess it's fair to say that when the corrections have been made, the report will be circulated to members before it appears in the National Assembly.
Let's agree that we will have those incorporated and then it be circulated so that it must not embarrass the committee in the end to find that we stand there and we have only what are not very thorough recommendations that only need to be noted instead of helping our department to transform the vocational sector. I think that is taken. There are minutes for the meeting we had with Cape Peninsula and Minister of Technology. No. I think let's correct that. Make sure that it reflects those apologies that were sent by honorable members. I don't think Anele would have a problem with that. It's a standard issue that must be incorporated. On recommendations,
Whilst you are looking at that, I think maybe just to say to members, we went to Cape Peninsula University of Technology after we realized that there were demonstrations by students. And that was after we had just visited a few other universities and public FET colleges in KwaZulu-Natal. And we observed that there is also one factor which accounts for the high dropout rate, which is not really always articulated. In universities, if you are in the system, because you're able to pay for fees in the initial year, and in the following year you're not able to pay, you are out. Now, that contributes to the high dropout rate, but it's never spoken about. It happens in the institutions without being given that focus so that we are able to resolve that. And similarly, when we arrived at Cape Peninsula, it was very clear that at a public level, it would seem that they say we can't exclude on the basis of financial grounds if you are really academically excellent. However, you find that a student is literally stopped at the entrance by a security officer to say, do you have anything to show that you paid? Then and they say no. They say next. That's what we're being told by the students. Now, what strategic intervention do we make in this regard so that we can avert this habitual disruption of academic programs at the beginning of the year in our universities? I think that must be a very clear recommendation that must come out from the committee, so that it could be a general response to one of the problems that arise from these institutions generally. And what strategy can we really recommend to also reduce instances of instability in the universities? Can we engage? Can we think of engaging with critical stakeholders to say how could we prepare for a better year in which there will be smooth registration, a clear position as to how you handle issues of retention of students that are academically well-performing in institutions, streamlining funding by NSFAS with appropriate bursar offices of the universities. All those issues which always come up when we visit these institutions. I'm trying to spark a response to a strong recommendation, because it does not seem to be emerging from our minutes. It would seem that this minutes might only end up being noted by the House, because you know that either minutes must be adopted or noted. We want our report just to be noted as one of those visits we had, or would like some strong recommendation which we think must spark a path towards the resolution of this problem.
There's an area that I also discussed with about it with myself and thought it has some answer. But I hear you raising it once more. I had thought that our position as the committee is that no academically deserving student should be left out of this institution, particularly when they qualify for NSFAS and all that. So it means they're supposed to be covered in that regard, regardless of whether you first coming or you were in that institution at all. Where we had a challenge was with regard to students who either failed the course or something, and they can't necessarily, they must pay for themselves, and NSF does not pay for those. In as much as we can't cause NSF, the policy is that they can't, and I don't think we want to change that policy. In that regard, what we were saying was that institutions themselves must work out mechanisms of supporting those. But anyway, because of them having not performed academically, they get excluded from NSFAS, from the system of NSFAS. But it's a category or pool of students who needed not to be allowed to drop out, because it adds to the dropout rate. So our understanding was that at least the institutions should develop mechanisms of catering for this kind of students and go on supporting them, both academically and even financially, even if NSFAS may not be able to take care of us. So I thought that's where perhaps we may be wanting us to say what exactly is our position. But otherwise, all of them, if they can be dealt with through NSFAS at whatever level, we are saying if they deserve and are performing, they should get NSFAS, and there's no problem with that. The only problem is when now you must be out of NSFAS.
Chair, mine links to ours, was not part of deal with this generally, my experience in higher education. I think what we need to say, we need to reaffirm, maybe say the minister should continue to remind institutions that I remember in 2005, the Minister of Education wrote letters to institutions saying that the issue of upfront payment for deserving students for NSFAS was dealt with, and then students should be allowed to register without that upfront payment who academically qualify. And I think that annually continues to be a problem for in some institutions who deny student access on the basis of an upfront payment. Therefore, the minister must be able to say that. I find it difficult to say students who are not academically performing, institutions should find a mechanism. Because a mechanism is there for NSFAS for students who academically perform. But we must say that institutions must strengthen their academic support program. Because if you listen even to the gentleman there was speaking from HPSA, he would emphasize the issue of academic support and social support of students, which is not there in some of other institutions. They only consider and think about those things at the end when students really do not qualify. Some are excluded as early as October because they didn't have correct results for them to go for and sit for exam. Therefore, we must emphasize the issue of academic support. It would be irresponsible for us to say, with the lack of funding, that the institutions themselves should find financial mechanism for students who are not academically deserving. Do you understand? Because students must take responsibility to encourage our students to perform. The criteria for NFRs, it's attainable for students who focus in doing work and studying. But there are those who fall on the wayside because of the lack of academic support. Therefore, let's emphasize academic support rather.
Look, Shepperson, we were students also, and I remember there was no NSFAS, there were other systems of bursaries and all those things. And I remember there was this condition that if you failed a year or did not gather sufficient courses to go to the following year,
they would always, that is the answer that I used. They would say, repeat your course at own cost, the course that you have failed, at own cost. But I was guaranteed, because I have this bursary, if I repeated on course, intake to the next level is almost like automatic. So there was this kind of motivation. But again, the question that you can ask is, if I didn't have money to start with and I qualify for this bursary, where do I get the money? That was the challenge. But I guess also, look, we can sort of make a moral recommendation rather than a mandatory one, and say universities must try to assist and must try, and really the emphasis on trying, that there must be some kind of, you know, understanding and all those things. But I don't think we want to give universities an unfunded mandate because they have problems as it is. But look, let's look at what universities are doing now with NSFAS. These students are allowed to repeat at own cost. But because they have no money to give, they end up owing universities. So when a student leaves, this student has a debt to NSFAS on completion. The student has a debt to NSFAS. The student also has a debt to the university. And this is what the universities were doing. They would then withhold the result and say, we don't give you the results, we don't give you the certificate because you owe us. They were not withholding for the debt to NSFAS. It was a debt for two universities. And what caused this? Students repeated at own cost, for example. Number two, NSFAS did not pay the whole amount. Now, and I know that this recommendation might be a bit outdated, because remember, we were addressed by NSFAS, was it last week? And CHE, yeah, which also said, no, we have agreed we are no longer withholding results. We only withhold the certificate itself, or the certificate itself, but we give students money so that they can go and work. So for me, I think this part has been, they have already responded to what the recommendation says from CPUT. As to how much they're going to implement that is another matter. But I guess I sympathize with the Honorable Makuvela. I agree with him 100%. It's also my feeling. But can we really, as a committee, give an unfunded mandate to university?
It is very clear that members are saying that we restate our position of non-exclusion of academically performing students by our institutions. And I think to monitor implementation of this, the minister must set up a responsive task team at the beginning of the year that must ensure that institutions do not countenance this perspective of retaining students that are doing well on the basis that you encourage them to pay money which you don't have. Because it is our stance, but it would seem that in some instances, people do get excluded, in fact. So maybe they must recommend, the minister must have that task team that runs around, other than the committee literally running around, because we've been running around, member to begin to assume that function.
We agree, Chairperson. The issue that students must not be, deserving students must not be excluded. But I want to understand, where do we put the burden? Is it on NSFAS? Because NSFAS gives X amount to this institution. And based on that, the institution says, the money that we have, we can only give maybe 2,000 students. And there is 2,005. The other five are deserving. They must not be excluded. We want to bring them in. Where does the burden go?
I mean, that is a philosophical question, because public universities have got a duty to serve the nation. And that duty is to provide education. And NSFAS's duty is to give funding. And his responsibility, again, is to
find creative ways of replenishing its resource base to be able to continue its mandate of funding. And we had said that the government must explore increased avenues for resource streams, including the National Skills Fund. We said here one moment and heard that they have reserves. They have reserves. I'm not sure if they were there last week to tell us about those reserves. We should be able to tap into these resources for purposes of career-directed programs of universities, so that those monies must not go to short courses, only hairdressing, protocol, how to bow when a minister comes into a meeting. You know, we need them to fund students. And the minister, also a creative way, apportioned 200 million, I think it was in this financial year, for those that were owing institutions so they could get a loan, and then you relieve the institutions of the debt that accumulated as a consequence of the retention strategy that we proposed. So those are some of the creative methods that we expect the ministry and the universities to always ensure to be in place to deal with this aspect. Ultimately, it is a collective responsibility of the state and its organs, because then the universities are the state organs of provision of higher education and so on. Because I think the fourth element we should always deal with is that public institutions should not be treated like private institutions, because they are subsidized. It is not, they don't necessarily depend on fees from the students. On a yearly basis, the state literally takes taxpayers' money and gives universities. So in response, they must also ensure they educate society, particularly the poor in the system. And that a student who fails one course, it is still there, I'm told, that you carry over one or two or three courses to the, and you study more to cover, if that is possible. But those that then crash against the academic exclusionary rules, then they'll be on their own, because then we don't want to contribute towards the bad effect that is caused by retaining underperformers or non-performers, actually.
I agree with you, Chair, on the intervention committee. I think we need that. It's very critical. Because in some instances, real institutions aren't just to our students. And there's nobody who's monitoring that. Do you understand? In some instances, NFS regulations are not implemented properly. But we can't just have an intervention committee with no pairs. Because in some instances, there are critical emergencies that we need. Therefore, the minister must look into an emergency fund in the beginning of the year and be able to say this intervention committee, as it moves around, if there's a crisis of intervention in Walter Sisulu University, that intervention committee is able to say we can assist in this university with this amount. I think the leader there is trying to say that. Do you understand? There must be something, because you can't say it must only be from institutions. And it's irresponsible, again, to say they must go to their reserves. Their reserves are from other things. For safety of the institution, financial management, and other things. That's why our municipalities are collapsing. We have destroyed reserves, because when we have crisis in projects, we go and take to reserves. Reserves are not for that, for security of institutions. Therefore, I'm saying I agree with you on the intervention committee. I agree with the Honorable Dukomo on the path for this committee to go with around and intervene on behalf of our students.
I guess Anel has come to some kind, because you said, and I think you've successfully done that, Chairperson, probing us to have a recommendation. And this recommendation says, all parties should do, and you have said the ministry is the institution should do everything possible to make sure academically deserving students are not excluded.
Somebody move for the adoption of the minute? Yes?
Chair, I move for the adoption of the minute.
Any someone? Okay, well, thank you. Nine minutes to lunch, if we ever have lunch.
I understand we don't have lunch.
The minutes relate to the adoption of the recommendations by the SOP. The bill has been passed yesterday. Are there any things that you would like to correct here that are not well captured? As matters arising, the bill was passed yesterday. Now we're checking if there are any typographical, grammatical, contextual misrepresentation.
One thing, Chair, just for comradeship, if any party, before we go to the chamber, if any party is going to have a declaration, I think other parties must be warned, because I think we're ambushed yesterday.
That's good. I think in this committee, one thing that I learned is that we developed some ability to engage very thoroughly so that every member's views are really taken very seriously. Because after all, we are public representatives. The moment you take an oath and are elected, you should be taken seriously by this committee in terms of the contributions you make. Now, the issue of raising the aspect of the division only helps to enhance the discourse in the House so that let's say, the ANC falters on a matter of policy and it could improve from whatever contributions from whichever organization, then that arises here. They're able to reflect about it in their own organization and then reinforce and complement whatever new ideas that arise from contributions of members. Because as a parliament and institution, we do contribute fundamentally to shaping and changing society. I think that is a good point. And I see comrades raising hands. I'll take over then.
I want to agree. And I know that we can't, as different parties, prescribe to each other. But you're talking about good practice. And I think we have been able to do that. But just one thing that I mentioned, you know, Chairperson, our reports have always been, you know, for me, very good. You nearly slipped yesterday. You nearly slipped up. I listened to how other chairpersons present their report. Because a report from the committee is not a report from the ruling party. It is a report from the committee. So in that report, you can't have a section that throws a low blow at Azabu, for example. You nearly did that, Chairperson, or maybe so that we just become very careful and then we are able to support each other in the report. It's our report. And when it's our report, the Chairperson detaches himself from if there are other members of the ruling party who come to speak, they will come and do that on behalf of the party. But you be our spokesperson.
Chair, I just take it that the issues were raised in good spirit, but what you had called us for now was to talk to the minutes. So this is slightly outside the minutes, but I think the flexibility that you've got, you allowed them. You should have adopted this and then go to matters of concern if there are. And so all I'm going to be doing now, Chair, is to focus on the matter at hand. On page 2, under 3.1, that bullet line, the second line says, was in line with other legislation similar. And I just thought that you must say was in line with other similar legislation. To me, that makes sense than the other. On page 3, the first line, the chairperson thanked the members and guests. to help the other guests, but otherwise I'm moving for the adoption of the ministry.
Usually no member leaves without speaking. They speak all of them and then we summarize. Let me hear.
Thank you, Chair. It was just on the matter before the proposal to adopt the minutes. Just on the declaration issue, I think one also has to take into consideration the logistical and practical ways in which parties deal with it. It's not at a meeting that a member will decide, I'm going to declare. It's often a caucus decision which can't be conveyed here, but it's usually conveyed in the programming committees by the different whips.
Thanks very much. And I will improve. I know I always learn from Honorable Gowon, one of my seniors, and I always avoid. You know, I really love members of this committee very much. I don't want to see myself one day, you know, attacking a colleague. I'm sure I'll leave that to the parties. Thank you very much. That concludes our meeting.